The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support comes from Grady Health Foundation, presenting Move for Grady Saturday, April 27th, featuring a family-friendly bike ride through Atlanta's in-town neighborhoods. There's a ride, run, or walk distance for everyone, benefiting Grady Health System. More at moveforgrady.com.
From WABE in Atlanta, this is City Lights. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thank you for listening. Our national parks are a marvel, and we have Teddy Roosevelt to thank. He established over 230 million acres of public lands during his presidency, including national parks, monuments, and wildlife refuges. On the importance of conservation, in 1908, Roosevelt wrote, "We have become great because of the lavish use of our resources, but the time has come to inquire seriously what will happen when our forests are gone, when the coal, the iron, the oil, and the gas are exhausted, when the soils have still further impoverished and washed into the streams, polluting the rivers, denuding the fields, and obstructing navigation." Dayton Duncan wrote and produced the Ken Burns documentary series, "The National Parks, America's Best Idea." I spoke with Duncan about chronicling the legacy of Roosevelt and other conservationists in the form of protected lands. Our conversation began with how they chose America's Best Idea to be part of the series title.
Well, we took that title, we borrowed it from Wallace Stegner, the great writer, who said it was the best idea we ever had. It sort of informed the whole series, I think. It's not a nature film per se, though there's a lot of nature in it. It's not a travel show per se, although we take you to a lot of places, and it's not sort of the best lodges in the national parks or, you know, a travel piece, although we do travel a lot. But the premise of it is that this is a uniquely American idea, that the greatest, most majestic, and I would say in some cases sacred parts of our landscape are not there for the exclusive use of royalty or the rich or the well-connected, which in all of history, those places had been set aside just for those people. That in the United States, this idea is in essence the application of the Declaration of Independence on the landscape, that these very special places are there for everyone and for all time. And that at the time that that happened, that was a radical notion, just as radical, as we say in the film, as the Declaration of Independence itself was, you know, a couple hundred years earlier. This was a radical notion that was born, I think, you know, not only because our continent had so many wonderful, majestic places, but also because it was here that that idea of equality and freedom had its expression in 1776.
Now, in addition to writing several acclaimed books and documentaries, you've collaborated with Ken Burns on several documentary series that are the most watched, perhaps the most appreciated programs in the history of public television. What made you suggest the national parks as a topic for Ken Burns?
Well, I'm a great park lover and would hope that I could also be now described as a park champion. I believe in the idea of national parks, both for the soul and for the spirit, and just for the chance for families or people to connect not only to something larger than themselves, those transcendent moments that you can find in a national park, but also connect to one another. It was in, I think, 1998 that I came up with the notion that maybe we should try to do a series on the history of the national parks. And, you know, I bring ideas to Ken at different times. He and I did a film called Horatio's Drive about the first automobile trip across the United States. I was really passionate about this story. Very few people knew about it. In 1903, Horatio Nelson Jackson, on a $50 bet, became the first person to cross the continent in an automobile, this newfangled machine. And I kept telling Ken that we ought to do it, and he'd sort of put me off, and maybe we'll think about it. It took me about 10 years to finally persuade him to do that film. With national parks, I set him down. I said, I've got an idea for a series. It starts with a president named Lincoln, which I knew would catch his attention, doing something that is, in essence, putting the Declaration of Independence on the landscape. He'd done a film about Thomas Jefferson, so I knew I had his attention. I said, it's about the national parks. It took me about 45 seconds to convince him on that one. So my average between those two was about 5 years of persuasion. It was just something that was deeply embedded in my heart and my passion that I really thought could be made into an interesting stories that approach the parks in a different way than they had been in the past. And I had, at that time, I had no idea about all of the range of fascinating characters who are the people that represent really what the story of the parks is. We tend to think that the parks have always been there. They haven't. We tend to think that it's sort of a top-down thing that the federal government, you know, declares a place a national park, which is what legally has to happen. But the real story of almost every national park, if you turn over that rock to say, how did this place become a national park? What you find is the opposite. You find individuals or small groups of people who fell in love with a place so passionately that they then dedicated themselves, sometimes for decades, to try to get the government to preserve it as a national park so that other people that they would never meet in generations they would never know would have the same opportunity to see that place and experience it the way that they had. And I find that just an incredibly renewable, inspiring story. Every story that we told introduces you to new characters, some of them famous and powerful, John Muir, Teddy Roosevelt, but many of them unknown and from all walks of life, men and women, black and white. They were just great, inspiring stories set against, you know, the backdrop of the Grand Canyon or Yosemite National Park or the, you know, the wonderland that is Yellowstone. So it had a lot of different things going for it, but the beating heart of the series is about to bring to light the stories of how these places, the fights often that were required to preserve a place like the Grand Canyon from being despoiled.
Well, it may have only taken 45 seconds to convince Ken Burns to adopt your idea for the series, but it was about 10 years in the making, I read. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'm the luckiest person on earth, I think, in terms of what it is that I do in making films with Ken and writing books. And so my, quote, job as both the writer and the lead producer for this, once we decide we're going to do it, was to start the research and the scouting for it. So my, quote, job required me to go to all the national parks and meet the people there, talk to them about the stories behind the parks, to scout the locations that we would want to go shoot, read every book I could find about those parks, then come back to the parks with a film crew. That was my, quote, job as well. Interview the people that know the most about it, then work on a script, you know, here in my attic office in Walpole, New Hampshire, and then bring the script to Ken and our very talented team of producers and editors and start making a film out of it. So that, you know, all that takes time. We're very slow at what we do. We like to think, hope that extra time that we devote in those, what Ken would call the hunting gathering process, and then in the editing process itself for a film like the National Parks, that was 2.5 years of editing. We put it together, we take it apart, put it together, take it apart, try to improve it with each of those iterations. So we take more time, but that's what we love. We love doing that. We love the sense of discovery that we always find in whatever topic it is that we're undertaking. That's what gets us up in the morning. And it gets, when you're shooting in a national park, a kind of landscape cinematography that we do, we shoot, you know, starting about half an hour, 45 minutes before dawn. The dawn hours, that early morning light, then the light before and during sunset are the two most dramatic times to be shooting outdoors. The lights, you know, more angular and shadows define things better. We would have to get up real early. If you're up in Glacier National Park in northern Montana and it's the middle of summer, you know, dawn comes real early and sunset comes real late. So they're long days. Or if you're shooting in Yellowstone in the middle of the winter to get the wonderful footage that we got of that place in the most magical time, I think, for Yellowstone, which is in the wintertime, it's cold. It's a short day, thankfully, but it's darn cold. And so, you know, they're either long or arduous days. And sometimes you get great stuff and sometimes you get skunked. But I'd have to remind myself and the crew and Ken sometimes, this is our job. Even if we didn't get any shooting done, we've stood here looking at the Grand Canyon. The light wasn't, turned out not to be great, but would you rather be someplace else than just standing here waiting to see if the light will do its magic at daybreak at the greatest canyon on earth? You know, not a bad gig.
Not at all. The episodes are effective as self-contained films and together comprise such a beautiful series. It seems so well organized and orderly, Dayton, but with years of research and filming, and you mentioned 2.5 years of editing alone, it's hard to imagine where you begin as a writer and producer. I wondered if the images come first or the narrative. Would you talk about the creative process for this series?
Sure. While we're doing the research and reaching out to people, we do interviews before, you know, we do the bulk of our interviews before I start to write a script, because we don't want the interviews to be a thing where you're just sort of trying to fill a hole in the script. That doesn't leave you the chance for the discovery of somebody to say something that you weren't expecting. We're doing those things at the same time I'm reading books and making notes and, you know, accumulating as much information as I can on paper and in my head. At a certain point, however, I've got to finally say, we can't make a film now until I write a script. And so then my job, my challenge, but the challenge that I love, is to try to make narrative sense out of all this. And the hardest thing really is all the things that you just decide you can't fit in. We can't tell every story. We don't cover the story of every national park. We have to pick those stories that fit into a tapestry that both moves you along narratively and chronologically. And also, as you said, each episode has to be able to sort of stand on its own narratively and dramatically. You know, it needs to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And you got to introduce characters, and sometimes you can go move back in time. All of that, it's, you know, it's a bit of a jigsaw puzzle, except that you don't know what, you know, you don't know what it is that you're, you know, constructing until you start doing it. So anyway, I get a script done. My wife, a former reporter, is always my first editor. Now my son, who's working with me on a couple of films with Ken, would read it and give me their comments. I'd give it to Ken, get his comments. We always have a panel of expert advisors to our films. We share early script with them, get their comments, say, oh, you're totally off base here, or you're forgetting this, or this is really good and very important, don't lose that. That results in a new draft of a script. When we're at about the third draft or fourth, then we'll start finally saying, okay, we've now compiled all this footage, we've collected all these photographs or great pieces of paintings and things like that. We've collected music that we think might work. Here's the script. Now let's make a film out of it. And once that happens, then it's still the same challenge. You know, the first draft of a script is probably up to and sometimes more than twice as long as the final script. And I do that deliberately because the writing is not a collaborative process, but filmmaking is. And I want the team, Ken and the others, for whom they haven't been doing all the research that I have, and, you know, don't know if it's not in that script, they're probably unaware of it. And I want the hard decisions that have to be made about what to take out, what to highlight, what to pare down a little bit. Those decisions are better made collaboratively if everybody's got this larger base of knowledge. So that's another thing that why our editing takes longer, because we're paring things down, throwing things out, rearranging stories. Sometimes then decide, oh, the next time we look at it, say, oh, we made a mistake there, didn't we? We shouldn't have taken that sentence out, or we shouldn't have taken that little story out. So we're always trying to improve and improve as we winnow it and try to get it down. Always with in mind, what is the essence of this story? What is the essence of this larger American story that we're trying to tell? And we try to keep all those things in balance and try to forestall for as long as we can having to make final decisions, because we're always open to suggestions. But we finally come up with at the end of the project with something that we're always very proud of.
Filmmaker Dayton Duncan on the Ken Burns series, The National Parks, America's Best Idea. We'll hear more of our conversation after a short break. This is WABE Atlanta.
Now on view at Skadfash, Manish Arora's Life is Beautiful. Renowned for dazzling designs in a rainbow of colors, Manish Arora has brought the talent and craftsmanship of India's rich sartorial history to the global forefront, earning international acclaim on runways across three continents. Designing in India since the 1990s, Arora's glittering garments celebrate extravagant expressions of self through varied materials, techniques, and silhouettes in a triumphant union of Western and Eastern aesthetics adapted to today's multicultural society with a touch of humor. Find out more at scadfash.org.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
You're listening to City Lights on WABE, where ATL meets NPR. I'm Lois Reitzes. Let's return to my conversation with the filmmaker Dayton Duncan. He wrote and produced Ken Burns' documentary series, The National Parks, America's Best Idea. Here, Duncan talks about the important role played by John Muir in the creation of America's national parks.
You come across in the films we do, you come across people that you can't really explain. You can only describe and stand back and be in awe of. John Muir, who was an immigrant, I should point out, from Scotland, he could have been, you know, a wealthy titan of industry. He was so good at inventions and things. But he also fell in love with the natural world. And by happenstance, he walked from Indiana to Florida, okay? And took notes of the flora and the fauna along the way. He had hoped to go to South America, but he got malaria and ended up getting on a boat and going to California. And he'd heard about this place called Yosemite. And he walked from San Francisco. Well, I took a ferry across the bay, but walked from there into the High Sierra and became transformed by his experience in the mountains and in that exquisite valley. Besides being a great inventor, besides being, you know, skilled in botany and flora, he turned out to be one of the great writers in American history, I believe. So he started writing about this stuff and became sort of the voice in the wilderness, if you will. And what a voice he had, talking about his experiences and seeing nature just as something that should be put to use, that it had certain places in nature had a different purpose, and that was simply to connect you to something larger than yourself. So when we try to pick out anything by itself, we find it's connected to everything else in the universe. And so he became this great champion of saving a number of places, expanding the size of Yosemite, making Yosemite a national park versus just under state control as it originally was. Mount Rainier became a national park with his efforts. He set in motion a century of conservation thinking in the United States, this immigrant to our country who pointed out to us what we should have known ourselves.
And this series brings out the fascinating contradictions of Theodore Roosevelt. He came from an elite family, yet as a politician, his public service demonstrated belief in a much larger segment of the people. He loved to hunt, and in fact, when he learned that buffalo were endangered and might become extinct, he made a trip to the West so he could shoot one and mount its head on the wall. How did a man who loved to kill animals and stuff them become a legendary conservationist who championed our national parks?
His time in the West transformed his life, as he described. He went out to also to get into the cattle business. There was a big cattle boom going on in the Dakotas and Montana territory at the time. And he was an avid hunter. There were a number of avid hunters in the late 19th century. He was, you know, in an elite part of that group. They believed in sportsman hunting, but they were dismayed and appalled at the just general slaughter of wildlife that was going on for commercial reasons. So there's a contradiction there, but not as big a one, I think, as we would like to think. It was his love of hunting that took him, you know, out into the wilderness and out into nature and helped him fall in love with it. Whereas Muir would talk about the spiritual aspects of being in nature. For Roosevelt, partly because he was a politician, he saw the democracy of the national parks. He called it the essential democracy of national parks. And he also was a vigorous president, used his bully pulpit, not to bully people, but to point people to things that they might not otherwise have done. And among those things was preserving and saving national forests, national parks. He signed what's called the Antiquities Act in 1906 that gives a president the sole authority to set aside federal lands as a national monument without needing Congress. And that's been an essential tool, starting with him, to save places when Congress is either slow to act or refuses to act. The Grand Canyon, the most, I would say, probably the most self-evident place to be a national park in our country, the fight to preserve it took decades. Roosevelt saved it using the Antiquities Act by making it a national monument. After that was 10 more years before it finally Congress could agree to make it a national park. Stephen Mather was the same way. Fabulously rich guy, successful businessman. He suffered from depressions, I think may have been manic depressive. He was inspired by reading John Muir and one time meeting him and found in national parks and in nature a rest for his mind and his spirit. And then brought his business savvy, his boundless energy to create a National Park Service. First of all, there wasn't one. The Army and other agencies of government were in charge of the parks, and they weren't being taken care of very well. And that got him ticked off. And so he wrote an angry letter to the Secretary of the Interior, which he could do because he knew the guy, saying how bad the job they were doing. He said, well, if you think you can do a better job, why don't you come to Washington and try? So he did. And he led this great campaign to create in 1916 a National Park Service and also further democratized the parks. And there's always double-edged swords in this, with the automobile taking off, of trying to, you know, refocus the parks to be more accessible by cars. John Muir wasn't so sure about that, but on the other hand, had to admit that with the advent of cars coming into parks, a different, more average Americans could now, parks originally were pretty much the preserve of people wealthy enough to travel by train and take 2 weeks away from work or a month away from work. Mather wanted more parks. He wanted more people to be able to come and experience it. And that was what he set out to do and establish the Park Service that I am very proud to say both Ken and I were named honorary park rangers, and I've got the hat to prove it.
How special is that? For the visual beauty and breadth of this series, one has to watch every episode. One outstanding feature of the narrative is inclusiveness. National Park Ranger Shelton Johnson is African American. We meet him early in the series. His commentary is memorable, if not poetic. His description of seeing bison on an early morning frozen park landscape and feeling he was thrust back to the Ice Age is unforgettable. And we learn about Captain Charles Young and the Buffalo Soldiers in this series. You also introduce us to an American Indian park ranger who explains that John Muir would have made a great medicine man. Please talk about your effort to include people in this series whose stories are not well known.
We didn't set out to say we need to find an African American or we must have a Native American voice or something like that. As we delved into the history of the parks, those things, you know, shouted out to us. These are stories. There's important stories here. And it is so much broader, ethnically, racially, by gender, than most people realize. And so those stories and those people are there because a telling of the history of the national parks that didn't tell those stories would be documentary malfeasance, in my view, and in Ken's. Shelton, I met him during early scouting in Yosemite. I went to a program they did about the Buffalo Soldiers. He and I exchanged cards. I told him I really want to tell the story of the Buffalo Soldiers. And Charles Young, who essentially was the first superintendent of the national park. And the Buffalo Soldiers were its first protectors. They were African-American soldiers called Buffalo Soldiers. They were part of the army out on the plains in the late 1860s, early 1870s. And the Indians referred to them as Buffalo Soldiers because their dark hair was curly like a buffalo's. And the soldiers took that, rightly so, as not disparaging, but a mark of honor. And so they liked to call themselves Buffalo Soldiers. There was no Park Service at the time, and somebody had to protect Yosemite from people herding their sheep into the high country and ruining it and enforce the regulations. As Shelton said, at those times in the 1890s, as an African American, even if you've got a uniform on, coming up to somebody and saying, I'm going to have to expel you from this park. So that can be the start of a very interesting day. Besides wanting to ask him about Buffalo Soldiers, you know, we had people, all the interviews we do, we'd have some open-ended questions. You know, the very first question we asked Shelton Johnson was, you know, is there one experience, if you had to close your eyes and just sort of say, I will never forget this moment in a national park, what would it be? And he, who studied poetry, by the way, in college, he uncorked this experience of seeing those bison on a cold winter day as he was driving the mail on a snowmobile from one part of the park to another, and went into this rhapsody. And I swear, both of us thought that John Muir's spirit and soul had just inhabited this young black kid from the inner city of Detroit.
One of the last jobs I had in Yellowstone was delivering the mail on snowmobile. There I was in the world's first national park, and I remember going down into Hayden Valley. There were bison crossing over the road, 2,000-pound mammals crossing over the road, and it was so cold, it was about 60 below zero. And the bison, as they breathed, their exhalation would seem to crystallize in the air around them, and there were these sheets, these ropey strands of crystals kind of flowing down from their breath. And I saw them, they just moved their heads and were looking at me, and I remember thinking that if I had not been on that machine, I would have thought I had been thrust fully back into the Pleistocene, back into the Ice Age. And I remember just stopping and turning it off, because the only way you could hear is to turn that thing off. And I would turn it off and I would listen. And I felt like this was the first day. And this morning was the first time the sun had ever come up. And the shadows that are being cast right now is the first time those shadows have ever been cast on the earth. And I was all alone, but I felt I was in the presence of everything around me, and I was never alone.
When he finished that, I was pretty sure that that was going to end up in the film, and that we use it to open our second episode. His own story, which we tell at the very, in the final episode, is an incredible story himself of growing up in the inner city of Detroit. The notion of national parks was alien to him. But he had a friend that had a job out at Yellowstone. And so he tells the story of getting off a bus, took a bus out to Yellowstone to take a summer job out there, and encountered a bison as he's getting off the bus. And then, like John Muir, that experience just transformed his soul and his life. And then he got a job as a park ranger, was there in Yellowstone, and then now out in Yosemite. One of the things that was great about his presence in our film, I think, is that he is dedicated to trying to make sure that not only are there parks and the Park Service more diverse, but that people who don't think that the parks are theirs can be persuaded that they belong to them too, and that they ought to come. I went with Shelton to his high school as we were promoting the film. I know enough about this stuff that we were going to show some clips to some high school kids and then take questions. But I knew enough that I didn't need to say much of anything. I just let Shelton take over. And the greatest thing was, the very first question this almost universally African-American audience of high school kids said, you know, lots of hands went up. And the first question was, how can I be a park ranger too? And that just warmed my heart and his. My friend Gerard Baker, I've known him for 40 years now. I met him when I was first going along the Lewis and Clark Trail to write a book about it. And he and I became friends. He was at the lowest rung of the Park Service at that time. And I was about the lowest rung of a writer at that time. I didn't have much money, but I was pursuing a story. And we met, became friends. And over time, he rose in the Park Service. He appeared in our film about Lewis and Clark. He became the first Native American superintendent of Mount Rushmore, and invited the neighboring tribes to come and give talks and set up a teepee and talk about the larger issue there. He was also superintendent for a while at the Little Bighorn National Battlefield and invited the tribes of the other, there are two American armies met there at the Little Bighorn. And he wanted to make sure that both sides felt that battleground was, you know, belonged to both sides, both the Army and the Sioux and Cheyenne and others.
During a 2006 visit to the Grand Canyon with my husband, one of the most thrilling experiences was attending a lecture by a Hopi ranger. And this was my introduction to the Hopi people. And it has been a fascination of mine ever since. But your inclusion of these stories in the series is reaching countless viewers whose lives it could change. And I think that's so admirable.
Thank you.
If you are just joining us, I'm Lois Reitzes, and this is City Lights. I'm talking with filmmaker Dayton Duncan, who wrote and produced the Ken Burns documentary series, The National Parks, America's Best Idea. Here, I asked Duncan about some of the expressions used in the series to describe America's national parks. There are so many ideal descriptions, I couldn't write them down quickly enough. But a few outstanding quotes here: empire of grandeur, a treasure house of nature's superlatives, geographies of memories and hope, a great breathing place for the national lungs, and perhaps my favorite, Earth's maternity ward. Would you touch upon the beautiful language used throughout the series?
Well, in honesty, a number of those phrases that you used are taken from a quote from somebody that appears in the film. Some of them, the treasure house of nature's superlatives, that's my writing, and Earth's maternity ward is a phrase I used. Ken decided on some films that he and I do, he will come to me at a certain point and he'll say, I want to interview you on this. The Earth's maternity ward just came to me in the midst of his interview with me. I had never written it down. I was talking about, as a kid from Iowa, going to Hawaii Volcanoes National Park, where a lava flow was underway. And we went out in the darkness with a ranger to where the lava was reaching the ocean. And it was just, it was just an unbelievable pre-dawn hike across the lava field that was already solid enough that, you know, and not so hot that we could get to this place. And then to be there as the dawn came up and film, and just spend several hours just watching that stuff pour into the ocean and realize that without congressional action whatsoever, that national park was being enlarged. Because when that lava reaches the ocean, it cools and eventually, you know, becomes land. And so I was just mesmerized by that. And I was just struggling to try to explain the euphoria that I felt. And the only thing I could think of was that I said, it's, you know, it's like going into the adrenaline or in the soulful rush that you get if you go into a maternity ward and see those little babies, and particularly if one of them is yours, that just exaltation that you get from it. And I was experiencing that in terms of new land. And so it was Earth's maternity ward. Empire of Grandeur and a number of those other things are, as we're making a film, we'll use quotes from historical figures and have great actors read those quotes. Empire of Grandeur, I think, was from something that either Stephen Mather wrote or Robert Sterling Yard, who was his publicist, wrote about that what we have here in these national parks, and we're not really promoting them and protecting them correctly, is an empire of grandeur. And so that seemed like a good title for an episode.
Definitely unforgettable. You mentioned the voices, many recognizable, including Tom Hanks, Adam Arkin, Derek Jacobi, John Lithgow. Did you have stars just lining up to participate? How do you get these people on board?
You know, this all begins with when Ken was making his first film as an unknown filmmaker, entirely unknown, on the history of the Brooklyn Bridge. And the grandson of Roebling, who was the designer of the Brooklyn Bridge, was himself an actor. And so Ken got to know him and asked him to be the voice of his grandfather, which he was happy to do and honored to do. But he introduced Ken to Julie Harris, who became a great actress, who became a voice in that, and she introduced him to some other people. By the time he got to be doing the Civil War, he had established contacts with lots of good actors who really enjoy that work. We also have voices that are some neighbors here in New Hampshire who read for us, generally just to fill in until we get until we know what the film finally is, and then we record, but some of them are so good that we use them in the final film. Tom Hanks saw Ken at some place and said, Ken, met him for the first time, like, how much I love your films. And that was when we were making our film on Horatio's Drive. And I told him, you know who the perfect voice for Horatio Nelson Jackson would be is Tom Hanks. And so he had that in the back of his mind. He goes, Tom, I'm glad you like it. Would you like to be a voice for us? And he said, I would love to. And so we asked him to be Horatio Nelson Jackson. And from then, he's been in almost all of Ken's films. But that first time, we spent a half a day with him out in a recording studio in Los Angeles, recording those voices. We pay the SAG minimum for someone to read our voice, which is not a lot of money. It's about, I think at that time, it was a couple hundred bucks or something, like $250. So I had the great honor, after he had finished reading, to present him with a check for about $256. And I just said, so I just want to give you this with a little bit of advice. Diversify. Don't put all of this in just one basket. But I think that they appreciate the care that we take. They appreciate the final film and the quality that they believe it has, and they're happy to do it.
Finally, why are the national parks a symbol of democracy at its best?
If you believe in the promise, still unfulfilled, of the Declaration of Independence, that there are certain self-evident truths, that among those are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, but if you also believe that all people are created equal, that they're endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. If you believe in that, which is what our nation was founded on, and a journey that is still struggling to fulfill those words, we've made progress in many places, but we're still far short in others. But if you believe in that, then you can also believe that we are blessed, that this nation is blessed with a landscape that is full of a treasure house of superlatives that can connect you to nature. They can connect you to yourself. They can connect you to other people. They can restore your spirit. They can make you healthier. They can make you better. And that those things need to belong to everybody, and they do. And what needs to be done is to encourage people to understand that, on the one hand. This is your property. Go out and inspect your property and make sure it's being taken well care of. But the other thing you've got to be doing to make sure of is that you make sure that you put it in your will for your kids, that it's protected for them and for their children and their children's children. These are shared treasures, and they need to be protected, but they need to be seen and experienced, and they need to be there when we're, those of us listening to this voice, are long gone. They need to be able to stand on the rim of the Grand Canyon, as you did, and have somebody explain it, whether it's a Hopi park ranger or an African-American park ranger, and hear the story of that. But also just that sheer awesome moment, whether you're with a large crowd or just by yourself or holding the hand of somebody you love, and just sit there or stand there in silence and let the whole transcendent wonder of it surround you. That's what it's about.
Dayton Duncan, writer and producer of the Ken Burns documentary series, The National Parks, America's Best Idea. The series is available now for streaming with PBS Passport. It will also be broadcast on ATL PBA starting July 7th. This is WABE Atlanta. The Georgia Author of the Year Awards were announced Saturday, and the winner in the children's book category is Tanya Valentine for The Little Taco Truck, illustrated by Jorge Martin. It's an imaginative story about inclusiveness that looks scrumptious and clever on the page. When I spoke with Tanya Valentine after the book came out in 2019, she explained how the story formed in her mind.
First, I came up with, where do taco trucks go at night? Because no one really knows where food trucks go. So it just sort of went from there. And I sort of just imagined this huge parking lot and, you know, what's happening. And I honestly had a very difficult time, because I think I'm just too much of a realist, imagining how trucks do things. They don't have arms or fingers or, you know, how can you? So I had to think of the movie Cars and, you know, how did they make that stuff happen? And I just kept rolling it around and around in my head and ended up with a little taco truck who, you know, kind of gets squeezed out as the competition comes in.
I wondered if this book was about immigration and assimilation in the United States.
Well, it is in a roundabout way. I tried not to be terribly heavy-handed with that. But I did hear Hillary Clinton in my mind saying, I think a taco truck on every corner is a delicious idea. I think she said that at some rally or event somewhere. And I thought, you know, if Hillary Clinton thinks it's a good idea, I think it's a good idea too. And I do feel like it definitely is sort of a secondary reason for the book, because I am wholeheartedly in support of, you know, food trucks from all corners. And I think there's room for everybody.
Well, I wondered, you live in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. Did you draw inspiration from the many international food offerings on Buford Highway?
Definitely, definitely. And I used to work downtown by the Capitol, so there was many different options down there as well. Before this, my husband and I lived in Los Angeles. My husband is a huge foodie, so he's all about especially the authentic Mexican food in Los Angeles. So he can remember the burrito we had at this one restaurant, you know, 16 years ago, and I have to say, yeah, sure, because I don't, but it makes him feel good, and he remembers it. So living with him has given me great appreciation for good food from all corners.
Well, speaking of those corners, tell us about the other food trucks in this story, because they come from different parts.
They truly do. And what's interesting is, as I've talked to parents whose kids are reading Little Taco Truck, Jumbo Gumbo is one of their favorites. And I've asked them, like, what? I had one mom say, my kid thought Jumbo Gumbo was hysterical. What did he do that was so funny? It's just like, I don't know. I don't know if it's his name or just how, you know, you do his voice when you read the book or, you know, whatever. But they love Jumbo Gumbo. So I would love to, you know, one day be able to ride a Jumbo Gumbo truck as well. I think my favorite is the Hello Gelato, simply because I love Italy and I love, you know, anything Italian and all Italian food. So he's definitely one of my favorites. And I just love that he comes in all chipper and bouncy at the end and, you know, he just knew everything was going to be fine.
Tanya, would you tell us about Jorge's illustrations and the process of working together on such a book?
Right. Well, this is actually my second book, but it's my first book traditionally published. My first book was called All Bears Need Love, and it was published via a digital picture book company. So this was my first traditionally published book. So I've learned so much. And as a first timer, they don't really ask you what you think or what you want. They just pair you with an illustrator. And thankfully, with this lovely publishing company, I mean, I never had any question that it was going to be a beautiful book. And then when they told me it was Jorge, I looked up his work and it's so different. Like, there's just so many different ways he could have gone with it. And all of his work is amazing, just all over the spectrum. And so I still had no idea what Little Taco Truck was going to look like. I always compare creating a book with being pregnant and having a child. Like, you just get these little, you're going to have a baby, and you're like, yes, and then you have to wait. And then you get a sonogram, and you're like, yes, but then you have to wait, you know. So you get these little, you know, dribs and drabs. And so when they matched me with Jorge, I was like, yes, but I had no idea, you know, what was coming. So they send what's called Folded and Gathered, which is basically the book without the binding, and just so you can see what's coming. And that was amazing. Like, that was the best sonogram ever. I could see what, you know, start to see how my book was taking shape and the beautiful colors that he chose. It just turned out so pretty. I was really, really, I couldn't have been happier to see how it turned out.
Tanya Valentine just won the Georgia Author of the Year Award for Best Children's Book, The Little Taco Truck, illustrated by Jorge Martin. You've been listening to City Lights, a celebration of the arts and the ways in which we express ourselves creatively. We'll be back tomorrow at 11 a.m. with dancer and choreographer Hope Boykin. She is retiring after 20 years with the Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater. Our producers are Summer Evans and Ryan McFadden. Kevin Rinker is our engineer and producer. And I'm Lois Reitzes. I'd love it if you'd follow me on Twitter at LoisReitzes. City Lights is now a podcast. Check it out wherever you download your podcasts. Thanks for listening to 90.1 WABE Atlanta's Choice for NPR.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is full of mysteries. Are ghosts real? Is that yogurt expired? Hey, the unknown can be scary. But when you donate to WABE, you know where your money is going. Your gift supports the journalism that keeps you informed and the programs that pull back the curtain on complicated stories. Help us make the world less mysterious. Become a member now. Go online to wabe.org/donate, and thanks.